It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
National Folk Festival is coming to Salisbury. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Starting in 2018, the city of Salisbury will be hosting the National Folk Festival for the next 3 years. It's a national traveling celebration of the nation's heritage. It includes music, dance, and traditional arts and culture. The event has drawn as many as 150,000 people and has generated as much as $30 million a year in economic activity. Sponsored by the National Council for Traditional Arts, a nonprofit that has taken the event from Chattanooga and Nashville to Richmond and Greensboro since 1934. Talk about the event and its rich history. In our studio this morning is Julia Olin. She's Executive Director of the National Council that puts on the festival. And also Laura Botanelli, Executive Director of Salisbury University's Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Julie, I want to start with you a little and ask you what attracted the festival to Salisbury in this area?
Well, the festival is awarded to prospective host cities by it's a competition, a national competition. And cities from around the country apply. And, well, Salisbury, at this particular juncture in its history, long history, really has a very special energy that feels like it's a place that's very alive, it's changing, and it just seemed like the right time to bring an event like the National to this city.
So is it, what kinds of, are there institutions going to be involved, like Salisbury University and so on? What's the situation with that?
It's a huge partnership. Mm-hmm. Probably most of the cultural and educational and of course, the city entities will be involved in partnering to produce this festival.
How important is that?
It's very important, and that's one of the things we were looking for, is sort of a broad enthusiasm and engagement across community.
And Laura, so you were involved in some of this, I hear. How did all this come about?
Well, I've known Julia for a little while now, for about 15 years through the Maryland Traditions Program. And every 3 years, they look for a new host city for the Nationals. And so in that time with Julia, it's come up. You think anyone on the Eastern Shore might be up for submitting an application? And so finally, City of Salisbury, through Jake Day's leadership, mustered the application. And we submitted it through the competitive process. And hey, look at us here. We're going to have a National Folk Festival in a couple weeks next year.
So what kind of things do we expect then to see? What kinds of performances, what kind of traditions are generally seen? And
well, just about every cultural community in the United States will be represented. It's the event is very diverse. So it will be everything from Appalachian ballad singing to salsa music from New York City, all sorts of traditional craft, bluegrass, blues, arts that represent the Asian community and the African diaspora community. Everything that's in our nation is going to be featured at this festival.
Anything, by the way, from the Eastern Shore? Do we know?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to ask.
Yes.
Of course.
There's a special area of the festival that is devoted exclusively to the culture of the host region and state. And so definitely the Eastern culture of the Eastern Shore is going to be featured prominently in the very first festival especially.
Mm-hmm. And we're excited to work with the festival in helping to identify a lot of those close cultural partnerships we have with traditional artists and folks that have been involved with many of the other cultural research on the shore related to the lifeways and occupations of Delmarva.
So, I mean, Laura, so what kinds of things do you think we might see from the shore? I mean, obviously, I'm sure we're going to have duck carving. I'm sure that's there, right?
I think we might be able to arrange to have a decoy maker exhibiting his or her talents. But if you think just a couple weeks ago, we hosted the Del Marvelous Festival at the Ward Museum. And so we had everything from a lot of things that were dealing with the maritime culture. So people from Smith Island, whether they were demonstrating Smith Island cake or doing crab picking or oyster shucking. There's a very obviously rich trapping traditions of the Eastern Shore. You think about gospel music and you think about the singing and praying bands, which is a very important gospel tradition, has a very strong Eastern Shore roots. So between music and material culture, there'll be a lot of the shore being able to see themselves on this national stage.
Mm. So I want to look at give us a sense about the history of this, because I understand it began, I guess, about 1934, although I guess there was one event in 1933, and a woman named Sarah Gertrude Knott. What role did she play in it? How did this come about?
The festival was first presented in 1934 in St. Louis on the organization then called the National Folk Festival Association. It was founded in 1933 by Sarah Gertrude Knott, a native Kentuckian who was very involved in the, it was the Depression, a lot of public programs. She was involved in doing some community organizing, working with poorer and immigrant communities in St. Louis. And she discovered that even more than the dramatic presentations that they were organizing, that the folks loved they would organize talent shows, and the folks loved to hear the music from the Ozarks or a polka from the German polka. And so she got the idea that's like people love their own cultures. Why don't we create an event that brings everybody together and it becomes the showcase of American culture in all its many forms?
And my understanding is she didn't have any training particular at all. She just sort of ran with this thing.
She did. Her training was not particularly music, but she really had some charisma and a knack, because she brought together the most prominent folklorists, ethnomusicologists, and other cultural specialists of her day to form the board of this festival and to stay with it for many, many years.
And I guess the first lady at the time, Eleanor Roosevelt, also became involved with it.
She did. It was the festival traveled around the country, and from 1938 to 1942, it was actually presented in Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C., and Eleanor Roosevelt served as honorary chair of the festival.
And this would seem to be a time that particularly in the Depression, there were a lot of folks who actually went out almost to discover America. I mean, I think about the famous photographs.
Exactly.
There were oral histories already in progress. I mean, this seemed to be a very fervent time in terms of the country trying to know itself.
Exactly. That's very true. And it was a time of the rediscovery of the sort of genius of the American people and the traditions that they kept and the arts that they made that were not of the conservatory, but generative, growing out of the experiences that people had in their lives.
I also understand that, I think it was 1938, Father of the Blues, W.C. Handy's first appearance and a desegregated appearance.
First appearance on a desegregated stage was at the 1938 National Folk Festival at Constitution Hall, which was run by the Daughters of the American Revolution and at that time strictly segregated. Now, how Ms. Knott and her cohorts got away with this, no one is ever quite sure, but they regularly presented black and white performers at the National Folk Festival over those years. In 1938, if you'll remember, this was the year before Marian Anderson was famously not allowed to sing at Constitution Hall, and Eleanor Roosevelt resigned from the Daughters of the American Revolution over that. So how the National Folk Festival managed to, I guess they just ignored it.
So the history, I mean, there's a, I guess the institution goes on, and but there's a discussion about how it was revitalized in 1970. What's the history there?
Well, Sarah had stayed at the helm for all those many decades and was getting up in years. And the country was changing, as Bob Dylan said. The times were a-changing. And the nature of festival work was changing. And the National had not really moved on with the times. And so it was in need of reinvigoration. And that came about through a collaboration with the National Park Service, and some new folks came in, became involved with the programming, and the festival started a tenure at Wolf Trap Performing Arts Park that lasted for 11 years. And the 70s was really an exciting time. There were so many traditions, vernacular traditions, that were coming out of different regions of the country. I mean, we were hearing Cajun music, real Cajun music, for the first time. All sorts of blues artists that recorded in the 1920s were being rediscovered and brought to the national stage. So it was an exciting time where a new generation of younger Americans, now my age, were getting in touch with the country's culture. And so the National was really a part of that. It became a part of that in the 70s.
Because one of the things that struck me, particularly in the 1960s, you had this almost this rediscovering of the country's folk music history and its legends and so on. People, Pete Seeger, and of course so on and so forth. It seems that a lot of that sort of the recognition that we were this multicultural, or at least multi-trending kind of a country.
Yes, and of course those folks that were at the grassroots, that were of these cultural communities, actually the originators of the art forms, were the ones that inspired the entire folk revival of the 60s and 70s.
So, and then the National Folk Festival, it returns to the road, I think, in the early 80s, is that right?
It did. In its early years, it traveled almost every year, tenuring from time to time in St. Louis for multiple years, or D.C. Went back on the road. Actually, the Filing Center at Wolf Trap Performing Arts Park burned down for the second time in 1982. Which was a major venue as part of the festival, but it was the catalyst for a decision or an idea that had been simmering in the organization about taking the show back on the road, and that began in 1983. The festival once again began to travel on a regular basis.
So as you go out into these various communities from city to city, obviously you stay about 3 years, I guess it is, so what kind of response do you get? And is there a sense in these individual cities that they begin to sort of know each other again? I mean, because you bring all these people. I mean, we tend to sort of get used to the idea, well, there are these people out there, there's our neighbors, but we don't get outside of the bubbles that were of our own friendship. Is there a sense of these cities beginning maybe recognize some traditions that they didn't realize or maybe didn't appreciate?
I think the festival actually is a mind-blowing experience. I mean... I've been doing this work for many decades, and it still blows my mind how amazing the country is, how amazing the traditions are, how there are things in every nook and cranny of the country that you just didn't know about. Well, the thing about the festival is that it's all there all at once, and that's what's so amazing about it, is like, from a small rural place, from the heart of an inner city, all these different cultural expressions are there. The festival now travels, you know, as you know, every fourth year it relocates, so it's a three-year stay in each community. And we're really trying to get at the best of the nation, the best of the host community and the region, and put these things all together in one event. And I think that the event is transformative. One, it truly takes everybody in the village to put it on,
right?
So everybody owns it, but it becomes a source of great pride as well as a truly delightful experience.
What do you think of the most unique venue you think you've been at, or that you're aware of, or the special? terms of cities or areas?
Well, you know,
I mean, that to put you in the spot of favoring one or the other, but
you know, you're like asking me to choose amongst my best friends and say which one is my favorite, because American communities, and this is endlessly fascinating to me, they're as different as individual people. Each community has its own unique personality as a place. And so we're not only meeting lots of individual people, we're discovering these personalities that each community has. Butte, Montana is very different from Salisbury, Maryland. And Bangor, Maine is very different from Richmond, Virginia. So, you know, it's something.
So we're living now in a what appears to be, at least in terms of awareness, much more aware of a multicultural country. And
yes.
We've seen, obviously, demographics are changing rather rapidly. We
yes.
see a rising Hispanic community and so on. How do you see the festival reacting or playing into those changes that we're now seeing? I mean, do you see it as facilitating that change in terms of understanding each other? How do you see the festival fitting into what we see as a changing landscape of America?
I see the festival as reflective, and it's sort of at any given time as if we could hold this giant mirror up to ourselves and say, who are we? Who are we as Americans? And that is constantly changing. And the festival has changed with the country. In other words, today, you know, urban arts are certainly a part of the things that you would experience at a national festival. Hip hop arts are actually 50 years old now, if you can imagine that. But you know, in 1934, we certainly weren't presenting hip hop arts; hadn't even been created in the neighborhoods or street corners of American cities.
Is part of this, by the way, this effort to also preserve the rich history? I know that Laura is involved in doing a lot of that, trying to preserve as well as expose the culture and the arts of America.
Well, people who practice traditions or tradition bearers, they're the ones that perpetuate and preserve. I think the festival's role is to bring these beautiful traditions to broader attention and celebrate them as as American treasures, really. And in that way, to foster interest and to give opportunity to the artists that practice them. So we can't do it all, but we're doing our part.
So, Laura, so how do you see us fitting into all of this over the next? Are we going to get to know ourselves, you think, in the next 3 years? I think I've suggested here.
Well, I think so, because we're going to have to work together pretty closely.
We're engaged.
That's right. I mean, just through the process of getting the application together and making our presentations, there's new partnerships that have already started to form in the city just from getting people in the room who maybe haven't been in the same room together for a couple of years. I know just having Salisbury University students, there's this interest in how the economic impact of this festival could be tracked and monitored and be a teaching tool for university students. So there's a lot of really cool things going. And so if the business community is thinking about getting to know itself as it relates to this festival, I just can't wait to see some of that economic impact data that the students get. But, you know, how is it, like 800 volunteers that need to
at
be
least.
Pulled together? So if you're listening to this, it's going to be our local United Way chapter that helps organize all those volunteers. So if you want to be part of this, holding this giant mirror up to ourselves, sign up at the United
Way.
Yeah,
it's a big mirror.
It's heavy. But yes.
So to Laura, it seems as if, and Julia sort of alluded to this, is that there seems to be a lot of activity, at least as I can see, going on in terms of Salisbury, not to, you know, boast or anything like that, but you have Third Friday and a whole slew of other things. There seems to be, and if you drive through downtown, I'm assuming downtown's going to be done by the time, right, by the time this gets off.
Partially, yeah.
Hopefully
so. Yeah, there's definitely a crackle everywhere, every corner. Everything's kind of popping at the same time. It's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, do you see this as part of that, of a trend for the city? Because, I mean, I will tell you that when I got here 10 years ago, not a lot. There was a lot of infighting. We, of course, we all know about that. But there wasn't a lot of movement forward.
It's changing. It's obviously it's changed. I mean, part of the reason that we were successful in our application for this event was that we had proved that our city was capable and worthy and able to make this type of stretch to achieve an event of this size. Really, it's that everyone is really complimentary right now to the overall ambition to improve the city, raise the profile, raise the morale, kind of just make this a better place to live, work, and play. And it feels different. I've been here for that long, and it's under the leadership of Jake Day and a lot of our other county and local leaders. It is a different place.
So, Julie, so what kinds of things do you think we should expect to see? I mean, obviously, you haven't lined up the acts yet, but...
No, not yet.
any inklings here about what kinds of things we will... I mean, we'll see, like, obviously, a lot of from the Eastern Shore, I guess, as Laura's mentioned, but outside as well, I mean, urban things, that kind of thing. What do you think we're going to see here? Or just... And how many acts? I mean, I guess there's what? What number of stages?
There's six to seven stages continuously operating. There'll be a festival marketplace that will be handcrafted items exclusively made in the state of Maryland. So it's showcasing, again, an aspect of Maryland culture. There'll be a family area. There will be the Folklife Maryland Traditions area that will there will be a huge dance pavilion that is nothing but dance groups of all different types. So people, this is for participatory dancing, not to watch, but to do.
You, I have to actually do it, you mean?
You will. Uh-oh. Well, we'll offer
well,
a
maybe
few
Laura
lessons
does. I don't
for
know.
Those who are impaired. So continuous activity, but it'd be everything from blues to bluegrass to mariachi to Irish, you know, on and on and on. Just every conceivable cowboy music, tamborita music, as well as material culture, craft demonstrations and foodways and things like that.
So, I guess in some ways, particularly for the folks on the Eastern Shore, they'll be able to see maybe a piece of the rest of the country that maybe they haven't seen before. I know that bridge gets kind of long there, but
they will. There will be some surprises, definitely.
Yeah.
So Laura, how do you think people are going to be reacting? I mean, think has there been some initial involvement there? What kind of feedback you get?
I think people are just really excited and trying to figure out how in the heck are we going to fit all these people into our city. It's going to be a really full and vibrant festival scene, and the downtown has got a great palette for it. And I know that Julia's team at NCTA can put on like the highest production quality events in the country. I mean, they've gotten awards on this. It's just they put on the National Heritage Award each year for the National Endowment for the Arts. I mean, a very prestigious organization that's going to be bringing their talent to our region. So not only great musicians, great artists, but just like the highest caliber of performance. And it's going to be a very, very exciting time to be at an event in Salisbury.
By the way, is this going to be like spread out throughout the city, or how do we have any sense about the landscape yet?
Well, the general footprint will be walkable, and it'll be probably downtown.
Okay, principally downtown. Okay.
Yeah, but it certainly has to be spread out because you know
six venues. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, and it really will be the best of the best. These artists, you may not know their name, but they will be the very best at what they do.
Well, we'll look forward to this, and we've been talking to Julia Olin. She is the executive director of Salisbury. She is the executive director of the National Council for Traditional Arts, and Laura Bottinelli, who is the executive director of the Salisbury University's Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. On May Day, there were rallies held across the country, with many of them singling out President Trump's Get Tough policy on undocumented immigrants. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. From New York to California, marchers made their displeasure known. The Washington Post found Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested some 21,000 immigrants since Trump took office. That's up about 32.6%. Deportations, though, were down slightly by 1.2% because of legal and bureaucratic issues. At the border, there's been a dramatic drop in apprehensions from more than 40,000 per month last year to just over 12,000 in March. Meanwhile, the president has said that those who come under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, should rest easy. I want to take a look at the impact this is having on the community. In our studios this morning, we have Pastor Greg Knepp. He's with the St. Peter's Lutheran Church. Also, immigration specialist Layla Barrero Kraus, also with CATA, a workers' rights organization. Professor Tim Dunn, he's with the Salisbury University, and Veronica Martinez, former student, actually, of the professor, and comes under the DACA program. And welcome to you all.
Thank you.
So, Layla, I want to start with you. What is the sense that you have, you're out there in the community working with them, trying to figure out how to deal with this changing landscape? We still don't really know exactly how it's all going to play out yet. What are you hearing from the community?
Good morning. Yes, I hear from many of our community members of the fear of being stopped by officers, ICE or police, local police. They're concerned about their children's future. They're concerned about their benefits that they get for their children will be stopped, even they are U.S. citizen. Their concerns about coming out in public or coming out to public areas and enjoy the freedom that they used to enjoy.
Go ahead.
We have been conducting outreach to several churches throughout the community on Sundays after their religious events and trying to bring some ease of mind to some of those community, especially because the bullying that the kids are getting subject to and their fear to come out to grocery stores, even to their church services.
So one of the things I ran across when I was up in Georgetown earlier this week talking to some undocumented folks is that there were a number in which, for instance, they had children who were American citizens. And so we asked, we said, well, okay, what happens if you're deported? What happens to children? And they said, well, the children will just have to come with us because there's no place for them here. You find that to be the case where you have these mixed families?
Yes. It is a lot of confusion with that because the children are U.S. citizens. And they're entitled to come and go as they please. And if they parents choose to take them with them, they have definitely that choice. They can register with the embassies and get the dual citizenship. So when they go to their country, they have as much benefits as, you know, they were born there. And at the age of 18, they decide to come back to the United States, they're still entitled to that. It is a lot of things that they need to do to obtain that dual citizenship. And they a lot of times it takes travel to Washington, D.C. to obtain the proper documentation for the children. Mexican embassy has been fabulous coming to the Eastern Shore to provide some of the services. They can take their kids or choose to leave them here with a family member or trust friend. A lot of times they think social services or the government is going to take those children away from them. We try to clear their mind and ease their spirit because they think those kids will be put for adoption. They will lose their children. And it's not necessarily so. I try to explain to them the only time the social services or the court system will get engaged with them is if they are mistreated or they are somehow malnutritious or they're not attending school or something like that.
Because one of the things, too, is I saw that there was a report that a lot of the police departments are now seeing less Hispanic women coming to report domestic violence. Less, for instance, and if there are ICE raids, for instance, particularly near schools, suddenly the attendance drops. Is that that's general sense that you get there by the community?
Yeah, I have seen some of that. And then we have over here a very active advocate for domestic violence. And we have tried to encourage the families to stop the domestic violence, to have a more positive presence in our community.
So I'm going to turn to Veronica. You come under DACA. Let me first ask you, when you heard that that program was in place a number of years back, what was your reaction?
Oh, it was a relief. It was a very exciting moment to know that we were getting that program. But I was also realizing that it was more than anything, it wasn't the solution. It was just kind of a placeholder. And that's what also a lot of DACA students are feeling right now. They're feeling the fear that that placeholder is going to go away. I mean, he has said that we should rest easy, but there's still that fear that it's going to be taken away soon. And there's fear also in that community because a lot of kids are aging in, 15 years old. They qualify to apply for DACA if they turn 15 years old. But they are, because of that fear that has been going around the country, a lot of people are not taking advantage of it, even though it's still in place. And so I don't know, I have mixed emotions, really. I was really grateful for it to come about. Back in 2012, I was able to work in different places with a legal work permit. I was able to finish school, but now I'm still just being realistic and also cautious that because it may be taken away. So I'm just trying to do what I can in the meantime. I have it until 2018, and we don't know if it's going to maintain or not.
Let me say, is it affected this atmosphere and this uncertainty? Has it affected the way you carry out your daily life? Are you more cautious? Are you? Because I know I've read some reports where some folks who came out of the DACA nonetheless got arrested and at least are facing deportation.
Yes, yes, it has, especially with the news that also you, I don't know if you've seen it, but there was a dreamer who was deported within hours. Within 3 hours, he was deported, even though he had DACA. And that's also a bit concerning, you know, because we have our permits, but we don't have it with us all the time. It's just not something that we should be doing. But even then, that also tells us that even if we have it, we might still be under deportation. We might still get deported. Hmm. So it's a little bit of concerning, yes.
Layla, because one of the things I ran across is that that you don't have to be a criminal in order to get deported. I mean, if they have traffic violations, that kind of thing. Are you, what kind of experience are you? And if you have any examples of it, of people who face that kind of thing?
Yeah, people who are stopped because they don't have a driver's license. They have no criminal background, but they need to go to the grocery store. They need to take the families to church. They need to take it to the medical appointments. They need to take them to school. And if they don't have a driver's license, they get stopped for any little, they change a lane without turn signal, something like that. It could be a case where police can stop them. There's also where they're working and ICE can come and get them at work, and they do an ICE raid. They don't have criminal records, but they're working because they're working undocumented. That is an act that the ICE will look into very hard.
So, Veronica, where do you come from, by the way? What country?
I'm from Mexico.
From Mexico. So what would it mean if you were deported to Mexico? If they said you can't stay anymore, What did it mean in terms of your own personal life? What would that mean in terms of your family? I mean, because I've talked to a number of folks who come under DACA, and that's one of the big issues that they face is that their parents might be undocumented, and it's like their whole lives will be then shifted out.
Yeah, I have been in this country for 13 years now. I am in the in-between place because I was 10 years old when I came here, and I have been here for more than half of my life here. But my family is a very mixed-status family, so I know that if I get deported, then that's probably going to go alone. But my family, my siblings, my nieces and nephews are here. Their life is here. This is where it is. So I would be separated personally from the rest of my family. But I also have my mom who's in Mexico, so I would be with her. That's a good thing. I would like to for her to come over here with us, but right now she cannot. But it's just, again, I don't know where my life would take me if I were deported. I know that I would have to start over once I can go to Mexico, because I have been part of this country now for 13 years.
I don't want to say culture shock, but what kind? I mean, I've talked to one of the DACA folks who said that again, like you, basically grown up here. And I think he came in, I think, when he was only like 8 months old, so he doesn't remember things at all. Mm-hmm. But that he would go back. He's visited Mexico, and that there's this gulf between his experiences in this country and their experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, do you find that to be the case? I mean, do you think that's it would happen? I mean, how do you think you would assimilate, I guess, for lack of a better word?
I think it would be difficult, especially since my Spanish is not as great as it used to be. But I'm also realizing that we started for us from the bottom when we got here, so it's possible. That's also to start on there. I wouldn't want to, but if that's unfortunately the case, then that's also what's going to have to happen.
By the way, do you remember how did you come across? How did you come here? Do you remember that? I mean, what was that like?
It was a difficult time to come. Yes, across the border when I was 10 years old. So it's just a memory that I try to repress sometimes.
I mean, I understand
because of the border patrol.
Sure. Tim, I want to turn to you. So what are the demographics in all of this? I mean, particularly for here on the Lower Shore, I mean, there's a lot of attention being paid certainly to Delaware, where there's a larger Hispanic population, but they seem to be fairly well organized, lots of organizations and so on. What does it look like in terms of those folks who are dealing with that as opposed to what we're looking at here in the Lower Shore?
Delaware has a longer history of kind of service provision to immigrant community and a larger kind of concentrated presence of immigrants working particularly in the poultry industry in southern Delaware and many poultry plants. And Georgetown has been a real center where, you know, half the town is now Hispanic and it's almost all of that is immigrant. Much of that is Central American, most of it. And Central Americans have had better chances to apply for legal protection of some kind, to apply for a political asylum. And a few cases, Hondurans and Salvadorans have been able to get temporary protected status as well due to natural disasters in their home countries and so on. So there have been a few more legal options for people there to at least apply for. And then pending, you know, case delays are pretty long. They can, you know, live their lives in the meantime. Religious groups really help band together. Multiple of interfaith groups came together to help provide legal assistance, language assistance, prenatal health care, kind of enrollment and nutrition programs and so on, and really develop a nice network of services there for an immigrant community that's very large relative to the local population. Here, our local, you know, native population is much larger. Salisbury is a much larger town than any of the towns in southern Delaware, apart from, you know, Dover and central Delaware. And the immigrant presence is more dispersed here. It's not so concentrated, but the overall numbers here are larger. But it's just people don't look like it because our total population is larger here. And people live in more dispersed areas. They're not so concentrated in specific neighborhoods as much, although there are a few. And we really haven't had any immigrant assistance center kind of pop up here. And, you know, you're looking at the immigrant community here also is more diverse. There's a lot more Haitian immigrants here as well as various Latino immigrants, mainly Mexican, but also some Central Americans. And, you know, we have a large Korean community. We have a large number of South Asian people from India and Pakistan here. The Asian immigrants tend to come more overwhelmingly with visas and with higher education and working in professional occupations quite often, or in entrepreneurial activities. You know, often coming with college educations really makes the adjustment process much easier, but still, you know, with challenges. And then the Latino immigrants and Haitian immigrants are more lower income. You know, many lack visas. Haitians have had some opportunity to get visas, but Latinos less so. And so you got that legal status obstacle there. And language barriers are larger as well for the group, and educational levels lower. So it's more challenging. And we just don't have a service provision center here. A Migrant Clinicians Network and Layla's group, Kata, and others have been working to do these outreach sessions to help prepare people in the event of deportation and family separation and so on. And really have realized the lack of services here. We need to establish something along those lines here. The foreign-born population in the three lower shore counties has about doubled since 2000. It's still fairly small, between 5 and 8% in the three lower shore counties, but it has doubled. And in 1990, the percentages were like 1%. So, you know, it's been a slow but or rather a fairly sizable increase, but it's still a fairly small overall. And, you know, there's a lot of adjustment issues that go along with it. And a great many mixed status households, which you've kind of been focusing on, of people with visas, people with legal, with citizenship, and undocumented household members. And it creates a great deal of tension and fear in the household if one family member is undocumented.
Why do you think it is that the lower shore doesn't have as many services? Is it just simply because they're not concentrated, or is there an organizational issue in the sense that the Hispanic community, at least on the lower shore, is not as well organized as, say, for instance? Or I see Layla smiling too, so she can jump in too as well.
You know, the Easton has established a multicultural resource center there that it really does work a lot with the immigrant community. Part of it is that the immigrant community is, again, a bit more concentrated there, more visible and obvious. But a lot of it, yes, is funding. And we just haven't had the local kind of, you know, nonprofit organizations and religious faith-based community folks come together to put something like that together. That's the model that's been the case in many other communities across the country. It just hasn't coalesced here in the same way. So, you know, for all the factors you mentioned, you know, but we're kind of heading in that direction as we go through this sort of crisis period here. I think it's becoming more obvious that we need to do something like that. You know, when we did a needs assessment survey over a decade ago of Spanish-speaking immigrants on the Eastern Shore for the local library association, they wanted to be able to serve people better, found that the biggest problems people faced were language barriers, transportation difficulties, immigration papers, work problems, and crime issues. And the biggest thing people wanted was English classes. And secondly, you know, they wanted help with transportation. And then, the you know, likewise, immigration issues and papers and work help, you know, to resolve work issues. And, you know, those are the kind of services that people need, that many other community centers around the country kind of put together something that can provide some of those.
You were smiling there a moment ago. How is the community responding to what you see as the needs of this particular community? Is it getting any easier? Are people more understanding, or are they less understanding given the atmosphere we're experiencing? What's your sense about that? I mean, are they responding, you think?
I think they have got used to the system in the area, and they stay quiet. They do not want to rock the boat. They keep quiet about employment issues, discrimination, mistreatment, because they want to continue working. So they do not want to create any more gravity to what is going on in the political, you know, arena with families being disrupted. And they are survivors. They try to do the best they can without complaining. They have to support themselves here and many times families abroad. So their main issue is work, work, work. And even if they're not being paid overtime or what they're supposed to be, and they're being threatened sometimes with, I'm going to call ICE, if you complain or if you have a workers' compensation case, they are afraid to come forward because they want to continue working and earn their living. That's the main focus, to provide for their families.
Pastor Knepp, your church, and you've been involved with trying to get assistance. What are you folks doing, and how did you get involved with this?
Well, I was asked by our local Lutheran bishop to coordinate an effort to mobilize congregations throughout Delaware and Maryland, because historically the role of caring for immigrants, for foreigners, for refugees has been a very strong one within the faith community. In fact, there are over 100 verses in Scripture that specifically call us to care for the stranger and for the foreigner. And so education is a big piece of it, because as Layla has just mentioned, for many of the immigrants themselves, they are living in a culture of fear right now. And that has certainly increased during the last year or so. And so part of our role, I see, in the church community is to help people become more understanding and aware of the true issues that immigrants face in the community. And so part of the role is education. Part of the role is reaching out and providing direct assistance to families if they do indeed come under a difficult moments where someone is in danger of being deported. An issue here locally is the fact that the Worcester County Jail in Snow Hill has 170 beds that are cells that are specifically contracted for detainees. And so we are putting together a program to visit, because a lot of times family members are afraid to go and visit the folks who are detained there, and also providing transportation. We were just involved with a case 2 weeks ago from Baltimore where someone was detained. They were brought to Snow Hill. They expect the father to be deported. The son is suffering in the last stages of leukemia. And so we tried to make arrangements to bring the son essentially for his last visit, to be able to say goodbye to his father before he was deported. And so to be able to help people understand that this is a real issue that touches people's hearts and lives in a political environment, which has frankly become just very nasty recently.
How do you, because you're out there, and what do your members say? Are there any members that say, gee, I'm not sure we should be involved with this? Or what's the sense that you get about the community?
Yes, our membership is a spectrum, just as you would find in society. There are some who are very, very supportive and are actively engaged and involved. And there are others who, I think, kind of roll their eyes and say, Pastor, can't you just stay away from that? But the answer is no. We have, as a denomination, and in fact, across the spectrum, the faith community is more united on this issue of serving immigrants and refugees than almost any other political issue that one might encounter, because Scripture is so replete with these very specific directives to assist our neighbor, to assist the foreigner. And we're not given the option of asking where they come from. That's not part of the option. We are called as people of faith to reach out and to help. And so that's the message that we kind of keep bringing.
In terms of the political establishment, because this is a very conservative area. I mean, yes. In fact, I think there's only one, a couple of, well, I guess like a couple of Democrats left in the state legislature from here.
Right.
And what is a political, how does that political atmosphere reach you? I mean, what kind of reaction do you get from them? Because they have to attend to the feelings of their constituents, and many of whom, conservative, and say, take, well, no, I'm sure would say deport them all. Others would say they broke the law, for example, if right. nothing else. They take a much less sympathetic line to it. What kind of relationship do you find there?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is, that's where, you know, fortunately for us, when the faith community approaches an issue from a moral basis, you know, trying to implement policies and advocate for policies that are more positive for immigrants and refugees, it's a difficult one. But you know, on the other hand, political leaders often want to show that they are, in fact, people of faith themselves. That's how many of them got elected. And so in a way, it becomes an opportunity, one might say, to challenge those leaders, that if you're going to take a moral stand on issue X over here, well, here's what your denomination, your faith community says about immigrants and refugees. You know, we expect you to also act in a way that drives your faith on this issue as well.
Do you find many of them respond to that?
There are some who do, but then there are others, as you might imagine, who are able to then use another line of argument and say, well, you know, most of my constituents say this. And so part of what we really have to do is let people know that there are so many misperceptions that are being spread, so many downright lies that are being offered right now coming out of the White House and other places. And we need to constantly combat that with real stories and true facts about the immigrant community and how much they contribute. How much they contribute economically and socially to our environment.
Well, we've been speaking with Pastor Greg Knepp. He's with St. Peter's Lutheran Church, also immigration specialist. Leila Borrell-Kraus also works with CATA, a workers' rights organization. Professor Tim Dunn here at Salisbury University, as well as Veronica Martinez, a former student of the professor, also comes under the DACA program. And we wish you, by the way, Veronica, all the best. And appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.